Well, welcome to this public lecture. Earlier this week, I was present at a discussion in the school of how we should handle the hordes of people who descend upon the LSE for our public lectures, and I explained to them that we didn't have that particular problem with mathematics lectures, but you are all extremely welcome, more so for that. Professor Winkler, who is going to give the talk, is well known to many of you already. He's here because he is a visiting centennial professor at the LSE, which means he's joined us for roughly 4 months, starting in January, during which many of our colleagues are collaborating with him in research projects, and he is has the pleasure of giving a course for us, a course of complexity, to our third year students. Many of you know his reputation, but I'll just tell you that he was has had positions at Stanford and Emory, and is now at Bell Labs in the Math Sciences Research Center there. Before that, he had a distinguished career as a cryptologist in the U.S. Navy, which led to patents in both in cryptography and in marine navigation, more surprisingly, and also led to a rather intriguing development. The Peter is actually banned in this country because he is the author of certain cryptologic techniques for use in the game of bridge, and these have been officially banned by the British Bridge Association. That's a lecture which I'm tempted to ask him to give now, but I think perhaps we better stick to the official title, which is Mathematical Methods in Telephone Routing, the Ring Loading Problem. Pete.
Thank you very much, Marvin. It is indeed a pleasure to be here. I've enjoyed already my first 2 months in London and at LSE in particular, and working with lots of very stimulating people on the faculty and among the students at LSE. My affiliation is actually a subject of some confusion at the moment, because what was AT&T Bell Laboratories has split. AT&T has split into three ways, and Bell Labs has split into two pieces. And my piece keeps the name Bell Labs and goes with the new company called Lucent Technologies. And the other part becomes AT&T Labs and stays with the company that provides long-distance service in the States and elsewhere.
All still at Murray Hill.
Beg your
pardon? All still at Murray Hill.
No. That part which the Bell Labs part, which stays with Lucent, keeps Murray Hill, and in fact Murray Hill becomes the headquarters for the new company. That's the larger part of the of Bell Laboratories. However, it's interesting that when the split was announced, and all the big muckamucks got together to decide what they wanted in terms of research for the two new companies, they ended up by declaring that both sides wanted all the mathematicians. And I'm not sure whether this talk is going to persuade you that this was, in fact, a reasonable decision to make. But it did result in the mathematicians being split. So some of my colleagues have got AT&T, which will be about a mile away. The impetus for this particular problem, I should emphasize that mathematicians at Bell Labs work on many, many different problems, including a variety of problems involving routing of telephone calls and telephone cables. And some of these problems are very complex and deal with the most sophisticated new techniques in operations research, linear programming, multi-commodity flows, and other things that you may have heard of. What I've done for this talk is to extract one particular little pearl of a problem that I want to tell you about, because in a certain way it's typical, but in another way it's nice, it's cleaner than other problems and perhaps more suitable for explanation in public lecture. The impetus of this problem comes from this slide,
which
now this is a very carefully copied cross-section of an old telephone cable. It's life size on the slide, but as Greg pointed out to me, it's not actually that big, as you see here. It's about this big, and I have a piece of it, which I carry around, but they wouldn't let me take it on the plane. So I don't know, but it was for something else. But it's an extremely heavy item. It's this big around, this long, and it weighs like that. It's packed full of copper wire. And now, at the bottom of the slide, you see what we've replaced this with to a great extent, which that's a cross-section of fiber optic telephone cable. Now, in fact, the little tiny black dots in that green ring are greatly exaggerated in size. But if I held up a piece of fiber optic cable in my hand here, you wouldn't be able to see it. And it's packed actually somewhat smaller than that, so it's a little tiny line like that. And at the moment, it carries about 100 times more telephone calls than that big copper cable, but in fact, this fiber optic stuff is almost unlimited in the number of calls it can carry. The number of calls it can carry depends on equipment at its ends, which at one end is lasers that send the signals, the other end is light detectors that receive them. And these lasers can be made, they're made sufficiently expensively, they can send bits at a terabit rate. And the transatlantic cable that connects us with the States has just six of these, the main transatlantic cable has just six of these little fibers in it. It's only about yay big and has a very tough nylon coating on the outside, which is what the sharks see. And that little cable carries all the phone calls. And it's maybe a little too small for my electronic mail, but it carries all the phone calls. Anyhow, so this is the good news. That they put this, there's only about 20,000 miles of this optic cable in the States. But after they put it in the ground, they discovered that the technology for using it accelerated at a greater rate than the demand for telephone calls. So they haven't had to put much more in. Now the question is just using it efficiently. In fact, after deregulation, they divided up this cable among AT&T and MCI and Sprint and other long-distance companies, many more coming. So that's all wonderful news, but there is a slight additional problem that this fiber optic cable has caused. And let me illustrate that by schematically. By saying that, it would be, if I try to cut this thick cable with a pair of scissors, it would laugh at me. But in fact, this pair of scissors will easily snip through a million calls worth of fiber optic cable. And in the States, we have a piece of equipment known as a backhoe. I'm not sure what that name is known here, but yeah, it's a little device with four wheels and it digs holes in the ground very suddenly. And that's sort of the paradigm for everything that cuts telephone cables in two. So, with the introduction of fiber optic cable, it became much more necessary to back up the phone system so that phone calls would go through, even though stuff is cut. In fact, ideally, we would like phone calls not even to be interrupted when the optic cable is cut. So you're on a phone, and somebody jams it back home into the earth and cuts their cable, nothing happens. The call is automatically rerouted. Okay. Now, how can that be? Well, the favorite piece of technology for achieving that is called a sonnet ring. Sonnet is an acronym. It stands for Synchronous Optical Network. And it's a U.S. standard, but there's actually a very similar European standard. So you see the same configuration here. And SAW is implemented generally in rings. And so this is a ring of, this is a schematic picture of a ring of fiber optic cable. And those nodes on it represent central telephone offices. But they could also be specific buildings or particular companies or almost anything connected by a ring of fiber cable. And one of the advantages of this, this configuration is a very simple configuration, of course. It's a vertex path to the graph, and everybody, every node gets the same equipment as every other node. And it can be outfitted to extremely high capacity. And the great part about it is that if somebody cuts through the cable at some point, then all the traffic is automatically rerouted the other way around the ring. Okay. No intelligence is necessary, and it all operates at the speed of light. So it's a wonderful institution, and lots of these sonic rings are being built. When I say that a sonic ring is being built, the fiber for these rings is mostly there already. It's a question of equipping the offices with the right equipment so that to make a ring of fiber in some big network graph behave like a sonic ring. Okay. The most important fact for our purposes is that the you can make these rings have more or less capacity depending on how much money you want to put into equipment. But the capacity of every link of the ring is the same. Okay. It has sizes that are called OC1, OC3, all the way up to OC48. And so our objective is to figure out where to put these things and what size to make them so we can put telephone traffic on these rings and have it be very resistant to failures. Now, in fact, we actually have a large piece of software we sold to telephone companies developed by Bellcore. And it helps telephone companies upgrade their networks with fiber, in particular to upgrade them with sonic rings. And the idea is that you take this computer program, you input your whole telephone network with all the capacities and all the demands and all the fiber is, and it tells you what's good places to put in sonic rings and how big they should be. Okay. This is a very difficult mathematical problem that's done with a lot of heuristics. Okay. Now, there's one very critical subroutine in this program called a ring loader subroutine. Let me tell you what this does. Well, it turns out that when you set up a sonic ring, there are little switches that you set. They can be reset, but they're set by hand at all the nodes of the ring. And what these switches tell you is for each pair of nodes in the ring, it tells you which way around the ring their traffic is going to go. You've got two nodes. Are they going to go around this way? Are they going to go around this way? And you can reset that if traffic patterns change. But relatively speaking, it's a constant. So now, what happens when the program considers building a ring somewhere? Okay. There are a ridiculous number of possible rings to put in and a reasonably complex network. But every time the computer considers one of these, it has to decide, well, how much capacity does this ring need? But in order to figure out how much capacity the ring needs, you need to figure out the best way to route all this traffic on it. And so the idea is, you route all the traffic some way, and then you look at any particular link, and you can compute the amount of traffic that uses that link. And you want to minimize, you want to keep as small as possible the maximum amount of traffic load on any link. That way, you'll build the cheapest possible rink that carries all the time. So,
let me give you an example. Here, I'll
let you try it, the problem. So here I have a ring with just 7 nodes, and for some reason there are only 4 traffic demands on it, and I've indicated those demands with cords in the ring. So this means there's a demand of 6 units of traffic between these 2 nodes, and that can be routed either the short way or the long way, all the way around the ring in this case. Okay. Now, how should we route these 4 demands? Well, a logical first thing to try would be to route everything the shortest way around. Okay. Well, if we route everything the shortest way around, then what will the maximum load on a link be? Can anybody tell me? 17, that's right. The link on the right-hand side will then get 9 units routed from one place to 8 units from the other for a total of 17. Can we do better? Not more to 14. And he's right. And this, you can see that on the bottom, that's how you do it. The 6 and the 9 are routed the short way, but the 4 is routed the long way around to the right, and the 9 is routed the long way around to the left. Kind of a surprising thing to do. But the result is that the heaviest link now, the heaviest loaded link, is this one over here, which gets a total of 14 units. Well, reasonable enough.
So what is the full mathematical abstraction for the problem?
It looks like this. So this is put in what we sometimes call Gary Johnson normal form. And the input to the problem will be an integer n as the number of nodes in a ring. And demands E sub ij, which tell you the amount of traffic between node I and node j. And this traffic, by the way, is traffic that flows in both directions. The directional aspect of the traffic is not a concern to us. And now, we're also given a bound L, so maybe 14 units. And the idea is to try to figure out whether we can route the things so that no link will get load more than this input number L. Okay. That's just another way of putting the problem. I could instead leave out L and just say I want to find out the way to do it that gives you the smallest L. And for convenience, we need a way to designate the two routes around ringing. Because it's not directional. Since it's not directional, clockwise and counterclockwise doesn't work. So what I decided to use was I named the link between node N and node 1 the back door link. There's always one way to route the traffic through that link, and I call it the back way. And then the other way is called the front way. So we have a lot of front-back decisions to make to try to solve this problem.
Yeah. Now the actual constraints on this problem are as follows.
The typical ring size is about 15 or maybe 20 nodes, maximum of 32 by current technology. So n is not a large number here. And the demands are traffic estimates. And they generally end up being integers with values between, say, 0 and 100. Nothing huge. Now, this subroutine that solves the ring loading problem has to solve it for an enormous number of possible rings. No, because it has to compute the projected cost of each ring in order to find out the best rings to build. If we only had to solve this for every room we actually build, then we could take our time and do a thorough job. But no, we have to solve it for every room that's even considered. So the conditions were we had to find a way to solve this problem in microseconds. Okay. And in actual practice, the routine that they had was taking hours to solve the problem. So what are we going to do about it?
Well, this problem falls into a famous class of combinatorial problems called the class NP. Okay? Some of my students know about this class. I'm going to tell you more about it in a few weeks. And the class NP is a class of problems which have the following properties. The problems which ask for a solution, ask for something which, if you have it at hand, can be checked. So, for example, if somebody tells you a particular way to route all those demands, it's easy enough to figure out what the maximum load is going to be. Okay. On the other hand, if you try to go through every way of doing something to figure out which is the best, it seems to require a lot of time. In this particular case, suppose the ring has just 20 nodes on it. Right? Now 20 is a pretty small number, right, for a computer. However, there are 20 nodes, then there are 190 demands, potential demands to route. Okay? Each one has to go either front or back, so the number of ways of routing these demands is 2 to the power of 190, about 10 to the 57th. Okay? Now you all know that 10 to the 57th is not a number you can deal with. The computer can test one routing every nanosecond, and the computer's been operating since the beginning of time. It's not even ever really going to get started on this problem. So we can't do this problem by exhaustion. Even though it seems like such a simple problem, it seems like we ought to be able to do that. Okay, so we want to know if there's a better way to solve the problem. Well, it's possible that there is a better way to solve every problem in NP. We don't think so. Generally, it's often the case that when you have a problem in NP, that you can show that it's a so-called NP-complete problem. That means that it's one of the hardest problems to solve in NP, and it's not going to be solvable unless everything in NP is solvable easily, and we don't know how to do anything. In fact, the situation is quite complicated. Exactly how hard could this ring loading problem be? Well, it could be, in principle, that the problem is NP complete, even if all the demands are either 0 or 1. Or maybe they're all 0, 1, or 2. Or 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. Or it could be that the problem is NP complete relative to the maximum demand. That means that the number N of nodes and the maximum demand D are considered the input size of the problem. Well, that wouldn't be so bad. Because then it might be that for fixed D we could do it. It could be NP complete relative to log D, and that would mean that if the demands were absolutely enormous and like 200 digit numbers, then we might have problems, but otherwise we could be okay. Or maybe it's actually an easy polynomial time problem. Well, in fact, this one is not the case. It's not that good. On the other hand, this one is not the case either. In
it's not that bad. We actually figured out how to solve this problem when all the demands are 0 and 1. That's pretty embarrassing. We're proud of solving this problem. Demands are 0 and 1. In fact, demands can be anywhere from 0 to 100. But sometimes you have to take what you can get. But except for that, we don't know where this problem is in the hierarchy. It's a very strange, it's an odd problem. We haven't got a polynomial solution for it, but as you will see, it turns out to be more amenable to a fast and accurate approximation than NP-complete problems usually are. It might be that it might turn out that this problem is one of the problems that sort of hangs in the balance. It's in NP, but it's not NP-complete. Nobody knows, and you can figure it out and be grateful.
Unfortunately,
it would not make our bosses happy to come back and say, well, this might be a hard problem. They needed some way to solve it.
Well, it turns out
there's one thing we can do, which is often done in combinatorial optimization. Lots of you here would think of this immediately. And I'm going to call this the relaxed ring loading problem. Well, in a way, you could think we have a binary decision to make in the original ring loading problem. For each demand, send it all front, send it all back. Think of that as a 0-1 variable. We could replace that by a real variable between 0 and 1, which says how much of it we send the front way, and then we send the rest of it the back way. So in other words, this is what the ring loading problem would look like if we were allowed to split the demands, send some front way and some the back way. We're not. But let's assume for the moment that we are allowed to split demands. Now, you might think that this problem is harder than the original one. All right, we had 10 to the 57th possible solutions to the original one. This one has infinitely many possible solutions. However, this problem is easy. Okay. It's an easy problem because it can be done by linear programming, but in fact, it's almost misleading to say that. It's even an extremely easy linear programming problem. It can be solved by a greedy routine, which takes no time. So the relaxed ring loading problem, we can solve in really less than a microsecond. And now, of course, solving it, what good does it do, right? It gives us a nice low maximum load, which I call L star. And that will be a lower bound on what is achievable without splitting. But we don't know whether the lower bound is any good. Okay. But a reasonable question to ask is, since we can solve it easily this way, can we then somehow take this solution and make a legitimate solution out of it without adding very much to L star? Now, in general, in combinatorial optimization, you can't get away with this. Sometimes there are very good non-integer solutions, and then when you put the integer constraints back in, everything goes down the drain. But an interesting thing happens in this problem. So, task at the moment is to figure out, well, we can solve this easily, can we possibly put a little more load, put a little more capacity in, and be able to handle the non-splitting case? Here's a critical observation. About the relaxed ring loading problem. suppose we have a pair of demands which do not cross. So think of demands as chords in this way. So here we have a couple of blue demands which do not cross. Okay. Now, if we put these two demands are part of the input to a relaxed ring loading problem, then we might expect that for this demand, some stuff will go the short way and some stuff will go the long way. And likewise, for this demand, some stuff will go the long way and some stuff will go the short way. However, I claim that that will not happen. Okay. Why won't it happen? Well, the reason is, see, this guy has, we'll say, an amount y going the long way around. And this one has an amount x going. You know, this one has an amount x going the long way around. This one has an amount y going the long way around. Let's suppose that x is the smaller of those two quantities. What we can do is take x, all x of this guy, and root it the short way. Take x out of the y here, and root it the short way. And if you check that out, you'll discover that we've lowered some of the loads on links this way and not raised any of them. So it never pays in a relaxed ring loading problem to split both of two demands if the two demands are non-crossing demands. So what? I mean, lots of demands cross. Maybe they'll be split. But how many demands can all cross each other? Suppose we take a solution to the relaxed ring loading problem, and then we look at the demands which are split. Well, according to this little observation, every pair of demands which are split must cross each other. So now we have the question, how many chords in a circle can all cross each other?
Not many.
The worst case is only n over 2. It might be the case that all the demands that cross exactly through the center of the ring, they all cross each other. And maybe all of those get split. But that's the worst case.
So now we have a scheme. We have an idea of how to solve the problem.
We solve an easy relaxed ring loading problem.
Okay. And then we just have a handful of demands that are split. Everything else is already sent all one way or all the other way by the relaxed ring loading solution. So all we have to do is unsplit these handful of guys in some reasonable way and hope that that doesn't add much to our maximum load.
Well, in fact, it's actually easy to see that these can be unsplit by adding at most 3/2 d for the maximum load. Okay. Capital D is the maximum demand size, maybe 100 units. So we have a guaranteed additive error of no more than 3/2 of that maximum demand. And that's very small compared to L star, because L star depends on capital D, but also depends on N squared. So this error doesn't depend on n at all. So that's good. And not only that, but we can do a funny thing here. I mean, how do we find the best way to unsplit the demands?
Well, one way to do it is to try everything.
Well, but we tried everything before, and it took us to the end of time. But that was when there were n choose 2 decisions to make. Now there are only n over 2 decisions to make. Okay? So now if there's 20 nodes on the ring, there's only, at worst, 10 demands we have to unsplit. How many ways to do it? 2 to the 10th. What's that? 1,000. Nothing. So
So, well, this is an exponential problem. You're not supposed to be able to do exponential problems, but for these numbers, this is trivial.
So we can just look for the best way to unsplit these demands.
And we have a guarantee of 3 halves D.
So this work, which was done by me and Alex Greiber and Paul Seymour, started a couple of years ago. We were happy about it and gave them a nice guaranteed performance and a very fast algorithm. But there was an annoying problem for us as mathematicians. And that was, although we could prove 3 halves D, we couldn't find an example which was worse than D.
So suppose that maximum demand is 100 units. So we had a proof that we would always be within 150 units of optimal in this solution. But in fact, everything we tried was always within 100 units of optimal in this solution. And it became a matter of pride. I mean, if we could guarantee 100, if they would like, we'd like to say so.
Well, it came down to a couple of combinatorial lemmas. And this is what the lemmas look like. So at this stage now, we have a total mathematical abstraction. There's no picture of a ring on this slide for the first time. And just two conjectures about real numbers. And these conjectures were announced at a meeting in Oberwaldbach and a few other places. And let me tell you what they come from. The second conjecture is exactly equivalent to the statement that you could get away with an error of D on the previous slide. The first problem is a special case of that, which we thought was the worst case. So imagine that you've solved the relaxed ring loading problem. And now you're looking at these handful of demands that are split, and you want to unsplit. Well, suppose a demand is split 90% one way and 10% the other, right? Yeah, then you pretty much know what you're going to do. You're going to send it all the way that it went 90% of the way last time. What's the least helpful that the relaxed ring-loading solution could be? Well, in the worst case, the relaxed ring-loading solution sends every demand half one way and half the other way. That actually is what happens if all of the demands originally look like these cross demands. Okay. In that case, you get the first problem. Let me just read out the first problem to you. The first question is as follows. Is it the case that if we get a list of real numbers from the unit interval, that's 1 up to xn, then we can attach signs to them? That's what these yi's are doing, right? So each yi is either plus x or minus x, plus xi or minus xi. Okay. And the question is, can we attach those signs in such a way that if we add up a bunch of these y's and then subtract the sum of the rest of them, add up the first k for any k and subtract the sum of the rest of them, you always get a number between minus 2 and 2.
No matter what the xi's are, there are yi's such that for any k, this expression will always be bounded by 2. So when Paul Seymour put this up on the board of Oberwaldbach, there was some incredulity from the audience. How could you not know the answer to such a simple question as that? Okay. Paul took this as flattery. So, well, I'm a good mathematician, but I don't know the answer to everything. And no. Nothing to do with you, Paul. I mean, this is just a stupid question, and the answer is either got to be yes or no. It can't be hard to figure out.
whether the answer to this question is yes or no, either it's true for all the reals and it's going to be some simple proof, or there's some simple counterexample. What's easy to prove is if you replace this 2 by a 3. That's very easy, and that's what got us the 3 halves d instead of the d. So, but I did say these were two former conjectures. So what happened was nobody solved the problem for us. We got tired of trying to figure out whether the answer was yes or no. I finally set aside a month. I said, I'm going to work on this problem for a month, and if it doesn't come out. At the end of the month, I had a solution which takes about 5 minutes. This is unfortunately what happens in mathematical research. So, and if you could just keep the right 5 minutes out of every month, you'd be all set. So here are the results. Conjecture one, special case involving the XIs, is actually true. Okay. And let's say there is a proof which maybe I'll even try to explain. Bad fortune to have me finish all your lines, but it has an easy but kind of weird proof. What does it mean for looking at a hard proof? Well, it can mean two things. It can mean it's a proof which is hard to explain, or it can mean it's a proof which is hard to find. I think this proof is one and not the other. Or it could be that just by a couple of things. The situation with conjecture 2 is even weirder. Conjecture 2, the one that really is equivalent to being able to solve this problem with a bounded, an error bounded d, is nearly true. Now, it often happens in mathematics that if you've got some statement, you're trying to prove it. That the statement is true, you prove it, of course, and if the statement is false, then in some sense, it will sort of generally be false. But this is false, but it's generally true. It's very difficult to make a counterexample to the second conjecture. And no counterexample will occur with any reasonable probability on any probabilistic model for where these demands are coming from. So what actually happened was, because of this counterexample, we couldn't quite give them the mathematical guarantee of an error d. So we just said, okay, we guarantee d. You ever get an error more than d from not in the solution? We put our heads on a chopping block. Well, of course, you know, they're never going to find the optimal solution in these anyway, so we're safe. Even if one, by some miracle, actually occurs, which you can't do better than the bounded d. Let me show you first. This is going to be a mysterious looking picture. So, but I don't know if you can read the numbers at the bottom of this slide, but these numbers are the percentages for splitting 13 cross demands in a ring of 26 nodes. Okay. So the demands are from node 1 to node 14, node 2 to node 15, etc. and the first demand is split. 83% back, 17% front. The second one, 23% back, 71% front, etc. Okay? And it turns out that for this set of numbers, you cannot get your error of D. It actually gives you an error of 1.01 times D. Okay. Not bad, but enough to disprove the conductor. And now, so what has that got to do with this funny picture? Okay. Well, what makes this a counterexample is that in this strange collection of line segments here, none of them intersects the diagonal line from the upper left-hand corner to the lower right-hand corner. These numbers are carefully chosen so that that diagonal line, which runs here, just barely misses all these little line segments. It would never happen unless you plan.
Okay.
Now, if I have the 5 minutes, I'll give you an indication of, it should be a proof, maybe minus a couple of details, of conjecture one, which we think is kind of a fun conjecture. Okay. There's a lot of different statements. It tells you that you can take a bunch of numbers in an interval and sign them such that the zigzag you get can be embedded in a Möbius band of width two, and a couple of other weird ways to state this problem. Anyhow, suppose I do the following. I take these xi's, I've got these numbers x1 up to xn, which are numbers in the unit interval, and I want to attach signs to them. One obvious thing I can do is I can keep all the partial sums between minus 1 and 1. Maybe I'll take plus for the first one, and then because I'm above 0 now, I'll take minus for the second one. Now, if I'm still above 0 in the partial sum, I take another minus for the third one, and so forth. Or just proceed greedily to sign the numbers, keeping all the partial sums between minus 1 and 1. Yeah. If that's all I do, then I won't get that 2 in the conjecture, I'll only get the 3. Okay. And then I'm going to propose to do something a little bit more subtle. Normally, when you take partial sums of things and you have a partial sum of nothing, you count that as 0. So I'm going to propose to vary that a little bit. I'm going to imagine that the zero partial sum does not have value zero, but value some number v. Okay. If I pick a number of v, which here actually I've chosen is about, like about minus 0.4. Okay. So I imagine that the sum of nothing is minus 0.4. And because I'm negative, the first x sub 1 gets a plus. And then this picture, the second one got a minus, third one got a minus, but now I'm below 0. The next one got a plus, the next one got a plus, and so forth and so on. And again, I stay between minus 1 and 1. Now, of course, I'm not really staying between minus 1 and 1, because I started with this funny value, v. I'm actually staying between 1 minus b and minus 1 minus b. Okay. Now, the catch is here, I'm now applying a definite algorithm to it. I pick a v. Let's say for definiteness, when I'm at 0, I always go up. When I'm above 0, I always go down. When I'm below 0, I always go up. And then I end at some value between minus 1 and 1, which I call f of v. So I've defined a function f of v. And now I claim that if we are so lucky as to find a value v such that f of v is minus v, then the whole thing works. And to prove that claim, it's just a question of making a little computation. Everything cancels out in a nice way, and all you end up with everything between minus 2 and 2. So this one started at minus 0.4 and ended at about plus 0.8. Well, it's too bad. If I had gotten it to end at plus 0.4, then I would have a win. I'd have a solution to the problem. So how do I know that there's going to be a value of v such that f of v equals minus v? Well, actually, there is a very easy way to try to solve this. You know that v ranges between minus 1 and 1. F of v ranges between minus 1 and 1. Okay. And it seems like you could use the intermediate value theorem to show that there's some place where f of v is going to be equal to minus v. Because we know that f of 1 is certainly going to be bigger than minus 1. And f of minus 1 is certainly less than plus 1. So by the intermediate value theorem, somewhere along the line, we get what we want. Okay? There's only one catch. So the intermediate value theorem requires a condition. Knows what the condition is. You know, the function is supposed to be continuous, right? Otherwise it can jump over any values it wants. You might be very happy to tell you a story about the intermediate value. So this function is definitely not continuous. It's not even close. I mean, what happens is, well, what does happen? Suppose we raise v a little bit. Well, the zigzag will move up. Okay. We raise v, f of v will go up right with it. Until one of these dots hits zero. And then all hell breaks loose, right? Now, who knows where the function is going to jump to now? Okay. So you raise v, f of v goes up, and then bingo, it changes to some new value. And it goes up again. And bingo, changes some new value. However, the absolute value of f of v is a continuous function. Now, why should that be the case? Well, here's a picture of what happens. So we're raising v now. And this is what happens when one of those nodes, here's the guy, this node just hit zero. Okay. The point when it hit zero, we change our mind, we're going down instead of up. Okay. But all that does is it flips the rest of the picture on its head. Okay. Actually, it might flip several times because there might be several points that hit zero at the same time. But it flips some segments and leaves other segments untouched. So the result is that the jump that f of v makes is always a symmetric jump. So its absolute value remains the same. So we have a continuous function now. It's too bad it's not the function we want, but it's a continuous function. Now, if we apply the intermediate value theorem to the absolute value of f of v, we will end up finding a point v such that either f of v equals minus v, or maybe f of v equals v. The latter is no good to us. So, know that when f of v is continuous, the whole diagram is just shifting up intact. So the slope of the function f of v is just 1. So that means that if we look at the absolute gravity of f of v, its slope is 1 whenever f of v is positive, and the slope is minus 1 whenever f of v is negative. So in fact, what is the picture of the graph look like? It looks something like this. This is the graph of the absolute value of f of v. It goes up the slope 1, down the slope minus 1, up the slope 1. It zigzags across in this very nice piece of rickrack here. And now, we want this thing to cross the line f of v, y equals minus x, f of v equals minus v. Okay. So here's the line. Okay. And now here's the fun part. This line has slope minus 1. Okay. So this line must cross the function at some place where the function slope is 1. Because it's parallel to the parts where the function slope is minus 1. At worst, it can cross it at one of those turning points. But that means that the crossing point that you get is exactly what you want. It must cross at a place where the absolute value of f of v is going up. Those are places where the absolute value of f of v is equal to f of v. So when the line crosses, that's a place where f of v equals minus v. I haven't run into another proof like it, but maybe you have. Now you can maybe see from this what that strange fractured graph on the counterexample. In some sense, it's a graph of every possible way of signing, of choosing those u's and v's. Okay. And what happens in the general case is that those things multiply all over the place, so they increase in length. You take a large example, the total length of all these line flows floating around the page gets very long, and generally speaking, you'll end up crossing this reverse diagonal many times. But that counterexample, you don't cross it at all. Okay, so that's the end of my talk, but I just promised you one fast story. I had a bad accident with the intermediate value theorem many years ago. And maybe that explains now why I only teach one course every 7 years. For my very first experience teaching, I had grants when I was a graduate student, and I was only put in front of a class at the last second to give me some supposed experience. And I nonetheless thought that I could do a wonderful job of teaching calculus, and especially when it came time to teach the intermediate value. So I prepared what I thought was the greatest lecture ever given on the intermediate value. And I explained some proofs, I gave a history of it reaches the square root of 2, and I get applications, cutting a ham sandwich in 2, describing Lake Michigan in a square, balancing a kitchen table on an uneven floor, so on and so on. So, in the afternoon following the class, one of the students shows up, and there's a professor with her, Nicole, professor of medicine before you had your doctorate. Really enjoyed your lecture today on the intermediate value theorem. I think I could have gotten more out of it had my background been a little bit better. So I said to the student, "Well, how can I help you?" The student said, "Well, could we go over the beginner's value theorem?" So that's the end of my talk, and thank you for your patience. Thank you.
Yes.
These rare counter examples, how much can you go to 1.1? Can we go right up to 1.5D, or do you have any idea about that?
Having spent a weekend making this counter example, I'm guessing that I could probably push it up to about 1.03 with a lot of hard work. I very much doubt that you could get it up anywhere near 1.5, but I don't know how to prove anything less than 1.5. There's a lot of room between 1.01 and 1.5 here. That's really strange, I think. You take larger and larger n, you take random demands drawn from some distribution. More and more, you need almost that full d with high probability. Okay. So you have a graph which looks like a spike going up at d. If you compute that error, and then there's this tiny dribble that sort of fell off the spike, the right hand side of the spike. Stuff that actually requires something more than one. But one is sort of the natural value. D is the natural value, but it doesn't 100% respect that natural value.
You would seem natural in a way to solve this problem by ordering the exile between the size. Let us know before.
The order of the xi's as given is important. And because they reflect the order of the demands around the ring. Change the order of the problem becomes different. However, it's a reasonable heuristic on the original problem to root the demands according to size. Right? In other words, take the biggest guy and root it, and then take the next biggest guy and root it, and so forth and so on. And that doesn't do so badly. It does, on the average, it turns out it does about twice as badly. It gets you about twice the error of this more sophisticated method. Decent heuristic. Well, that they put it in, they use it, they give them a guarantee. It runs fast. And of course, they want. And there are lots and lots of other problems involving setting up these sign-up rings. So in that sense, they want lots more. And they've already forgotten this problem because it's in the software, and it's gone. You can never keep these guys really happy. Bruce?
Fully understand, is it the problem being solved in the design phase or in the dynamic routing? I seem to understand the design phase.
Right. This problem was a problem for the software that does the design. Okay. Now, when you actually build the sign-up ring, you have plenty of time. You can take all day if you want to write a program to design how to set the switches in that sign-up ring. And you might change those switches as demands change.
So they're not going to call by call?
Well, no, heavens, no. That's, these things are a question of traffic pattern. Yes?
I was just wondering what happens to one of these biggest things to these.
Yeah, what you have to do is you have to do a little bit of a binary search to find the break. You send some light through, and you look at your various checkpoints, find out where you're seeing light. So narrow it down to one segment, right? And that segment, generally what you do is you reach into the ground and yank the thing out and put a new one.
There's no linking up fibers, as it were, like in the 400 one. You had to get to make sure you linked each one to one.
Splicing fibers is tricky business that we don't know what to do. So there are certain natural terminuses where we have amplifiers and regenerators, and we replace that line of fiber there. It typically takes about an hour to fix a problem like this. Before we had the sign-up rings in place, someone put a backhoe through the one little tiny optic fiber
that connected Newark Airport to the rest of the world. And of course, that shut the airport down dead for an hour.
Any other questions?
Are we allowed to know where the sign rings are?
Sign rings are being built all over the country.
Oh, come on.
I'm actually not sure what the status of sign rings is in this country. But I think it's likely that there are some in operation and there are plans to put most of the traffic on sign rings after some period of time. That's just a really nice technology. We're very happy with that.
They are digging up my hometown of Egham at the moment, and I'm not sure whether that's cable TV or sonic rings or whatever. Anyway, before I forget, there is a reception upstairs afterwards. People who don't know, take the lifts immediately outside and go up to the fifth floor and follow the floor. Everybody's invited. I'd like to thank Peter for presenting more. We have all the ingredients. We have a real problem, which really is not a mathematical drive problem, which leads to, nevertheless, very interesting mathematics. And